Welcome back to the Tier 1 podcast. Thanks for joining us for this first episode of Season 2. In this episode, we are sitting with Jake Mushaney from Unknown Munitions. Check him out at unknownmunitions.com. Jake is here to teach us all about how to reload at home. This is a great episode for anyone who's interested in starting to reload, who's looking at what equipment they need to buy and what the process is exactly. And even if you're a seasoned reloader, there's some great stuff in here that you may not already know. If you haven't heard of Jake, he runs Unknown Munitions, which is a company making premium custom ammunition for hunters, precision rifle competitors, and anybody who wants a higher quality round. Jake goes through his own personal process in here, so you can see exactly what he does. You can even follow along, because a lot of the gear that he uses is stuff that you can buy and fit in your home workshop. So there's tons of actionable stuff in this episode. But in the meantime, enjoy this chat with Jake Mushaney of Unknown Munitions.
Yeah, I think generally maybe the state of the union, the political atmosphere, the kind of riots here and there.
Yeah,
the Black Lives Matter, people seeing guns or you know, some type of issues in city centers and feel like they, you know, they have no way to protect themselves. Then you have a new president that has just come on, who is anti-Second Amendment, wants to restrict guns and ammunition, you know, in every way possible. So that's also scaring people. But generally, I would say it's directly related to a record number of, again, new gun owners who, when they purchase a gun, they purchase ammunition with it. And it's kind of a compounding effect. So the more ammo starts to disappear and shelves start to look bare, it makes people buy more ammo, even when they don't need it. So it's the same storyline as toilet paper. And I'm not sure if toilet paper was as bad in the UK. But
oh, yeah. You know,
if you read an article that says toilet paper shortage, even if you have enough toilet paper in your home, the first thing you want to do as a human who needs toilet paper is run to the store and buy more, even if you don't need it.
It's
a same story as ammo, I think. Yeah. And
I mean, the thing with toilet paper is you can't really make your own.
That's right. That's
at least
right.
You can with ammo.
Maybe there's some other methods for cleaning, but generally, you know, people like their level of comfort and, you know, and it's funny too, because the same way with ammo is once the toilet paper started to disappear, you didn't pay attention to the brand or the quantity. You walked in the store, and if something was there, you made your purchase. It could be sandpaper for all you cared. It could hurt. And you were buying it because it was there. So the same thing is true with ammo. People are buying ammo for cartridges they don't even own.
They don't
even have a rifle or a handgun chambered in. You know, 40 Smith and Wesson, and all of a sudden that's the last box of ammo on the shelf, so they're buying it, you know, it's very funny.
Yeah, for sure. It's a weird human psychology, isn't it? There's a shortage, everyone's going to rush out and try and buy it.
So that's
definitely the trend then. And do you see that abating in the States? I mean, is it getting better, or is it how are the manufacturers responding?
Well, I think in general, everybody has some type of conspiracy theory related to, you know, manufacturers are holding back components to try and control the people are doing this. I don't believe in any of that. I just think that it just simply demand. I think manufacturers are doing their best to pump out as much as possible. But let's take if you take Vista Outdoors, for example. Vista Outdoors owns Federal and CCI, which are two of the four major primer manufacturers in the United States. And the CEO came out and blatantly said that they're using most of the primers for their own ammunition. And you can't blame them for that. But, you know, on our side as reloaders, you know, primers are a necessity to load ammunition. And as we see less and less available to us in the market, you start to develop those kind of theories, or you blame the manufacturer. But really, they're just putting the primers in their own ammo. Federal says they have at least a 12-month backlog of ammo orders right now. In other words, they've already sold all of their ammo-making capacity for the year 2021.
Wow.
So if you wanted to be, as a dealer or as a retail seller, if you wanted to purchase some ammo, some federal ammo, it's more than 12 months away before you get it. So I don't really, I mean, that all that ammo will hit the retail market at some point during the year, but it's just you know, as a seller, or, you know, if your shelves are bare at your, you know, small gun store, small business owner, it just, it's not looking up. And yeah, I think, I hope that by the middle to the end of the year, maybe people's closets start to get full, and maybe the hoarding mentality slows down a bit when they realize that Biden still can't get anything done as far as restricting guns or ammo. But the moment he opens his mouth and says, you know, we're going to vote on this or we're going to vote on this, people are just going to continue to freak out a little bit. And
I mean, in a sort of a roundabout way, he's doing wonders for the gun industry because sales are so high.
But obviously
that nervousness is unwanted. Does that affect your business? Because Unknown, you supply obviously a cut above the average ammo. Is it affecting you that there is a shortage of this, or affecting you even that there's this massive demand? Are you seeing people who can't buy off the shelf ammo are coming to you and trying to get ammo just because there's none out there? Or has that not really affected your buyer base?
It's had a huge effect on us in a number of ways. We went from, you know, having, let's say, 350 available ammunition products on the site in stock at any time. So our business model is we load to order. So we carry components. And for example, a 143 ELDX might be used in 5 different cartridges. So it's, you know, trying to balance inventory is tough. But yeah, so it's affected us in the fact that, you know, the average order went from 50 to 100 rounds of ammo up to 500 to 1,000 rounds of ammo.
Wow.
It's gotten to the point where we removed everything in stock on the website. So there's no ammo normally in stock. And then we add ammo in waves in order to try and, you know, try and average out our production capacity.
And
if I had everything in stock on the website with unlimited buying amounts for the consumer, we would be in the same situation as Federal, where we would have 1 year of orders trying to work through them. I mean, people will literally buy whatever we put, you know, in stock on the website. So, it's tough.
I know what that's like to some extent, because at Tier 1, we've found that demand, when we release a batch of bipods, there's already people queuing up. They buy them, they're sold out the next day or 2 days later. There's a long pause, load of people queue up. We release a batch and they're all gone. And so we never have been I don't know if it's just because of coronavirus. I don't know if it's because of what's happening politically, like we've just discussed, in the States, but we seem to never be able to keep pace with production, even though we're adding machines and we're increasing production. It's been crazy this last year. It's good crazy. It's a good problem to have, but it's interesting to hear that it's clearly industry-wide that this is happening. So Unknown Munitions, can you tell us a bit about what the company is and what it does and how it all got started?
Yeah. So my experience in shooting in general actually started with a friend getting me into it, you know, many years ago. And we happened to be mountain biking friends and friends in general. And, you know, he wanted me to buy him a mountain bike, or I wanted him to buy a mountain bike so we can go mountain biking together. And he said, if I buy a bike, you know, you need to buy a rifle. And that's basically how the shooting game started. And then the business started really out of I wanted to teach my kids how to hunt.
Okay.
So to that end, I wanted them to be able to shoot as far as possible. So just, you know, getting into shooting, researching cartridges, bullet performance, things like this. We moved from California to North Idaho, where the business started. And, you know, I don't think the business would be as successful if we had tried to start it down there in California.
Really? Why is that?
There are a lot of restrictions in California as far as what type of weapons and ammo, you know, you can purchase. And just let's say it's a liberal state. So
Yeah, for sure.
So I think the move up here, to Idaho really helped us to get the idea for the business and getting moving. We're very young. We've only actually been in business for 18 months, although it's been a idea in the making. It took nearly a year to put all the licenses and insurance and things like that together in order to start making ammo legally and for sale to the public on through a website. And there's been a lot of bumps, speed bumps along the way, hard lessons learned, threats of lawsuits. You know, different financiers locking up our money once they found out we made ammo, such as PayPal. Yes. If anybody, any of you using PayPal, just know that they are a completely anti-Second Amendment. And if you were to sell something guns or ammo related, they'll lock your account with many, many thousands of dollars stuck inside. And then, of course, PayPal owns Venmo, so it's the same situation. So finding, you know, that was just one hurdle to overcome, finding a card processor or a merchant bank that would actually work with us for ammo.
Who do you use now out of interest?
The card processor is authorized.net, and the merchant bank is, it's called like Start One. But basically, you lean on authorized.net as your processor to find a bank that will work with you. And that's kind of a drawn-out process. But I will say that once your processor and bank are solid, initially the bank held our you know, money for 5 days at a time. So you only get your money in your bank account from your processing five days before. But now it's 24 hours. And, you know, so it's a process. But, you know, that's one of those hurdles you overcome through business. And
So you mentioned right at the beginning there that you wanted your kids to get into hunting. What is it about hunting that's special to you then? Why were you so keen for that?
So it's not something I ever did with my own father. I just wanted to, I'm kind of, I guess, an old school type of guy. I want to teach my kids how to be self-reliant, autonomous, how to take care of themselves, and, you know, teaching them respect for nature and conservation. And I just, I wanted to have something that was ours. So it started off with my son at a very early age. We started backpacking when he was five.
Right.
And when he was five, we did like half of the John Muir Trail, which is a very long trail in California. And he did some things that no other five-year-old I ever thought could do, you know, through pushing him and training and things. And that just kind of blossomed into, we turned it into kind of backpack hunting. And,
that's awesome, man.
Yeah, so he was able to take, so it's my daughter also. So my son is 11, my daughter is 12. This last season, just a few months ago in November, my daughter took a cow elk and my son took a mule deer buck.
Oh, congratulations, man. That's fantastic. Yeah,
appreciate that. And, you know, I didn't, I would rather have them take the shot than myself. So I didn't shoot anything this last year. And you know,
yeah, just busy coaching.
Oh, yeah. And the whole, so the whole business is kind of, and that's the majority, I would say, of our clientele. The majority are hunters, you know, looking to you know, take out any variables in their system, their equipment, you know, in their process. And one of those is obviously shooting. You know, if you want to shoot better, you know, you need good ammunition. So that kind of starts the conversation with a lot of our customers.
And when those customers are coming to you, you're finding they're already educated and they know that they, you know, what they need, or or is it just that they know they need something better and more reliable when they give it over to you to decide that?
Yeah, I think you know, hunting, if hunting is important to the hunter and they are a rifle hunter, you eventually, I mean, you're always in the process of tuning your gear, and part of that gear is your weapon and ammo. And once they realize that maybe they've reached the capacity of their equipment, basically, a rifle is only capable of a certain amount of accuracy.
Yeah.
And the ammunition itself is only capable of a certain amount of accuracy through extreme spread and how it's built. And maybe once you reach the capacity of your given system, you just want to get a little better. And we actually have in some shirts designed right now. And one of them is, you know, make the one shot count, because it's for a hunter, how much money, time, planning goes into taking one shot. And it's our ammo that's you know, helping to get them there. So I think they realize that they need to have quality ammo if they expect, you know, they expect the amount of performance out of it. And
I think it becomes like that, doesn't it, on the when it's kind of a weakest link situation where at that moment, that critical moment where you take that shot, it's gonna break at the weakest link. And if you have cheap ammo, or if you have a cheap scope, or if you know maybe you're not well trained enough, your fundamentals are bad, wherever the weakest link is, that's where it's going to go. Mm-hmm. And when you're spending a lot of money to go on these big hunts, obviously you're trying to eliminate those weak links. That's certainly how we've seen it from our customers. That's what they're looking for. Eliminate mm-hmm. those weaknesses from the system. You said that there is a gun is limited in the accuracy it can achieve. Is that, I mean, can ammunition outperform a rifle, like say a store-bought rifle, you know, a good quality one, but not a custom built rifle?
I think that you know, if a rifle is capable of 1-inch groups or 1 MOA groups at 100 yards, and it's a 1 MOA gun. I mean, the best ammo is going to get you to that 1 MOA, and then yes, it could, the ammo in itself could take you past that 1 MOA if the chamber barrel and rifle was capable of that, and of course the shooter. We've had rifles, so everything we do is hand loaded custom ammunition, whether you purchase a load we've developed through the website or you have your own load data we can load to. We also do load development for a customer, and that's done one of two ways. They can request a load development box where we will build them, you know, an optimal charge weight test or a seating depth test, you know, based on their parameters, or they can send the rifle in to us and we do all the work for them. So we get to see a fair amount of rifles passing the shop from, you know, one end of the spectrum to the other. So let's say a Browning Hell's Canyon long range all the way to a full custom rifle that's $10,000 without a scope. After shooting enough various types of rifles, you begin to realize right away when you have a well-chambered, well-built rifle with a very high quality barrel, it's different. It shoots different. It's capable, you know, of easy tuning, I should say. You know, it's not hard to find a load that shoots well. Whereas, you know, a factory production rifle, even a, you know, Christensen, Seekins, any production rifle of that kind, it takes a bit more work, but you can get down to half inch and below, half a MOA and below, but it, you know, it just takes that little bit extra work to get there.
So you really have to be looking at a custom build for achieving those final few percent.
Yeah, I mean, and you have to be realistic with your expectations of your weapon system. So if you know, if you're spending $500 on a Tika T3X, you need to be realistic. That's probably a 1-inch gun. If you spend $10,000 on a rifle, a realistic expectation would be sub half minute, meaning that if you get down into the thirds or quarters, that can be expected with good load development. And that comes from, like I said, that's a quality barrel with a perfectly straight quality chamber job and a good build with a properly bedded action and a free floated barrel. And you put all these things together and all of a sudden you have a package that's capable of itty bitty groups.
Yeah.
You know, so just, realistic expectations is I think important. And that follows through with hand loading ammunition. Yeah. The amount of money you invest in the tooling you use to build your ammunition will be directly reflected in the quality of, you know, the resulting product.
Well, yeah, that's an important point, I think. If you're just starting out in hand loading, I mean, there's a whole bunch of questions that I'll ask about this. But starting out in something, it's obviously you've got the different tiers of gear. So there's the entry level, and there's all the way up to the really expensive stuff you might use in a commercial situation, like no doubt you use. For a hand loader at home, how much are they going to expect to spend? And then what can they really expect from those loads in terms of performance versus what a setup like yours would produce?
Mm-hmm. So the equipment that we use in the shop here, there's no motorized or commercial equipment really. We are using the same equipment that the garage hand loader would potentially use if they're looking for, you know, the highest tier level of tooling. And we could break it down, you know, process by process. But I think to start for the beginner hand loader, there's two things that you need to be able to separate two parts of your ammunition. And one of them is understanding how the components work together.
Mm-hmm.
And the second would be understanding how to put them together.
Yeah.
These are two very different things. So understanding, you know, how to make them work together would be things like powder burn rate, bullet stabilization, load development. These kind of things are how to make everything work together. And then once you can separate the two, understanding how to put everything together in a consistent way.
Yes.
And, you know, I will say that, you know, just deciding that you're going to start hand loading because of a shortage, there's a lot involved, a lot to learn. It is a simple process. If you were walked, you know, if you had your hand held through the process in the shop here, you know, within 4 hours, I can have the whole process explained to you. And then, like you said, what are they going to have to invest in tooling? Well, we could add it all up and, you know, let's say it's $15,000. For all the, you know, top tier tooling needed to load ammo the same way that we would.
Yeah.
Once you figure out what areas need attention and what doesn't, for example, for the longest time before the tooling was at the level it is today, people, you know, you might neck turn trying to make up for some other deficiency in your process.
Right.
But we don't do any neck turning here, and we're able to produce very good ammunition without neck turning or without weight sorting bullets or brass or things like this. So I guess we could get into the process and we'll talk more about that.
Yeah. That sounds good. So if somebody is coming into hand loading, I mean, obviously a lot of them are going to be looking to make their own ammo because of the shortage, but many are looking for more precision. In that comes, you know, consistency in the process. It then immediately occurs to me, well, the biggest inconsistency is the human behind the tools, because it's the same with your shooting. You know, you don't know that you've done it the same way yesterday as you did today. You don't know that, you know, unless you really worked on those fundamentals. So from your perspective, I guess, what's the one biggest mistake that you see new hand loaders making that they should avoid or that they can work on themselves to try and achieve some consistency when they're loading?
I would say the biggest mistake is probably overthinking the process.
Okay.
I always try to generally have a, I guess you could call it an engineering mindset, but I look at things as a mechanical process. And if you keep a mechanical mindset while you're looking at whatever stage in the process you might be working, it's fairly easy to figure out, you know, how to make that process the best possible. So I guess we'll give an example. We'll take the seating bullet step of your ammo making process. So seating the bullet, generally the base of the cartridge, the case head, is resting on a flat surface. The bullet needs to be pushed into the neck, and you raise the cartridge up until the bullet impacts some resistance, and as you use the leverage of your press, you're pushing the bullet into the case. So if you try to imagine all the points of variance in that process or slop or play in the press, you can start to build a mental picture on what you're actually doing by seating a bullet and how you can make that process more consistent. So let's take for example, if the bullet is pushing on the powder because it's a compressed load, well, that powder, that pressure pushing upward on the bullet from the powder being settled at different heights will push on the bullet, and you'll have inconsistent results, you know, from base to ogive with your finished ammunition or finished product. If the bullet is sticking inside the seating stem in any way, as you pull the ram down, you could pull the bullet out just a little bit from the neck. So good release on the bullet. Good seating stem to bullet contact. In other words, using a seating stem that fits well to the bullet profile you're seating. So the larger amount of surface area contact between the seating stem and the bullet, the more consistent ammunition you're going to have. And if you get some of those pesky seating rings around the top of your bullet, you know, that's just, you're touching the bullet on the stem and just one fine line. So it creates a lot of pressure on that one point of impact. So you can actually take a bullet, whatever bullet the hand loader in his garage might be using, and chuck it up in a cordless drill. You can get some honing paste, dip the bullet in the honing paste, disassemble your die and take the seating stem out. And while you're spinning the bullet with the cordless drill, you can polish the inside of your stem to increase your surface area contact.
Okay.
So that's going to help with bullet release on your downstroke. It's going to increase surface area contact to eliminate those rings, especially on, you know, today's match style bullets that have super thin jackets. But that's just one of those things that you learn, you know, after many thousands of rounds and working with different bullets every day, how to make everything kind of come together. So if you look at that one process as a mechanical process, you know, and choice overload is kind of a real tough thing for a new hand loader, because how many different brands of dies or types of dies might you have out there? And if you just understand that the only purpose of the die is to align the cartridge and the bullet properly, and then to push, you know, give the bullet somewhere to stop so that your upward force, you know, is pushing the bullet into the cartridge. So, you know, dies, brands, things like this, you can make any die work really well if you just understand the process and what you're doing.
So it comes down to your process as the individual a little bit more than the quality of the die, is what you're saying.
Yes, you can make really good ammunition with a cheap press and a cheap die if they are. And again, that's just the one. So seating the bullet and quality, meaning that your base to ogive is plus or minus 1/1000th of an inch. That's our goal here. Right. You can make really quality ammunition with a cheap press. And now it just takes more work to get there, more skill setting up. So if we take it to the other end of the spectrum and you want to use a Redding competition seater or a Whitten seating die with a Area 4190 press, believe me, your setup is going to be, you're going to hit the ground running with minimal knowledge and setup experience with higher end tooling.
Makes sense.
I think that probably applies to almost every piece of equipment in your hand loading process. You're giving up, as you try to save money on a specific piece of equipment, you're investing more time and labor, you know, into making that piece of equipment work the way you need it to. Whereas when you're spending, you know, when you're buying the best tooling the industry has to offer, you're eliminate kind of that lag time, I guess.
With that in mind then, because I guess there's going to be a piece of gear where it's harder or requires more elbow grease, if you like, to make up for a lack of accuracy in the actual tool itself, or, you know, in the precision of that tool. Where should people be spending their money most? You know, which piece of gear should they be spending the most on, and maybe not worrying about another piece of gear in their reloading kit when they're setting up?
It is, for me, it's hands down the powder measure.
Okay. Why is that?
Well, I think for so long, hand loaders have tried to make up for poor powder measurement through other means in their process. And that's where kind of neck turning comes in. If you have a perfect powder charge in every one of your cases, in other words, kernel accurate, perfect powder charge down to 0.02 grain accuracy. The rest of the process, like that, the next most important part is neck tension, but the powder measure, you need to invest your money in that piece of equipment. We use FX120i scales with auto tricklers.
Okay.
And you can have kernel accurate powder throws within 10 seconds. Any powder, any measurement. It's by far the most critical piece of equipment in our shop today.
Really, really. So that's where the consistency primarily is coming from. And that's where it could go wrong.
If
you didn't get that bang on,
I would say probably the most. So let's put price points on it, because I think that's important for a beginner. We're talking about $1,000 US.
Okay.
For a ready to go auto trickler setup, and we do sell those on the side, and we export them all over the country at this point. I'm sure there's, you know, dealers here and there, but you guys can Google auto trickler would be the easiest way for you to find some information about it. But basically, it's a Bluetooth connection between your phone or iPod or something of this nature, where you download an app, makes a Bluetooth connection to the scale. You set your charge weight from above. It auto throws a bulk charge, and then through a straw that rotates, it trickles in the remaining powder to hit your target set weight. Wow. 0.02 grain. So 1 grain of H4350 powder weighs 0.02 grains. So in other words, it is kernel accurate powder throws each and every time. If you invest in any piece of equipment, it should be there. And I would say the most common powder measure today for the hand loader that's just getting started, they might be pushed towards an RCBS Chargemaster, and that's more the $350 price point.
Okay. So there's a big difference between those two.
There is, and there was a new machine that just hit recently, and that's called a RCBS Matchmaster.
Okay.
And this is more like a $800 to $900 price point machine, which it's very surprising to me that people are spending that amount when they can buy an auto trickler for nearly the same price. And I can't tell you how many customers so far, just our last batch of auto tricklers that we sold, there was at least three or four guys that had called and say, I'm tired of trying to make this Matchmaster work, or I'm sending it back and I need an auto trickler.
Yeah.
And you know, so there's some allure to the two different systems. The allure being the RCBS Matchmaster is a one-stop shop. It is, you know, built by a reputable manufacturer. It is all built by one person, and they have some trust in that brand, and they expect, you know, they're advertising a certain level of performance and so on. Whereas the auto trickler with the FX120i scale, you know, there's different suppliers. Area 419 makes the upgrades.
Okay.
A&D makes the scale. It's an FX120i.
Yeah.
And then auto trickler makes basically the rest of the system that drops the powder and trickles it in to make that. It's a scientific lab scale is what we're starting with. So
that it's kind of an automated system.
It is. It is. It's once you set the charge weight, in all three of those are. So whether it's the charge master, the match master, or it's an automated powder dispenser.
I'm looking at the auto trickler now, man. It looks very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So we run, I think we're up to 12 or so of those sets in the shop, and
really?
We run three of them at each station, because with three of them running simultaneously, there's no lag time for the person that's powdering the cartridges. Right. So it's literally dump and then dump and then dump. And, but that, I mean, independently, that piece of equipment has more impact on the final product than any other piece of equipment in the shop.
Fantastic. Well, there you have it. That's where to put your money, everyone. $1,000 well spent.
It is, and you know, a buy once, cry once thing. You can, you know, like anything in the world, you can spend as much money as you want. And there is actually a step up from that. There's a machine called a Prometheus.
Oh wow,
and that's like the $5,000 mark.
Wow.
So of course, you know, I've never seen one, touched one, used one, but you know, the auto trickler is more than capable.
Yeah.
Of building the best ammo around. It's all you would need.
Yep. Very cool. Very cool. Yep. So they needn't. So what is the process? I mean, we're backtracking a little bit here, but I realize we skipped it. For a reloader, what is the process they've got to look at to make their own ammunition? Make it well. We've covered the auto trickler. So what's the process and what's the gear?
So we'll just try to keep it basic and simple. So we'll start off with new brass that's coming in bulk into the shop. Uh-huh. Bulk brass in general, you know, the necks have been hitting each other in transport as they're being made. And of course, there's all levels of quality of brass, and that will directly impact your ammo also. That's another topic, I think. But okay, so the new brass comes in the shop. Our first step is to expand the neck.
Okay.
And this is extremely important for neck tension. Expanding the neck is done with a mandrel.
Yeah.
If you picture an upside down bullet that you insert into the neck and then pull back out, the expander, the best ones are made of carbide steel. The two manufacturers we get from are 21st Century and Sinclair.
Yeah.
And the expander mandrel is exactly 1/1000th under bullet diameter.
Okay.
So as an example, if you're shooting a 6.5 Creedmoor, the bullet diameter is 0.264 inches. Your expander mandrel is 0.263 inches.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So to start off, to be able to use a mandrel, you need a mandrel housing, which is basically like a die that just has a screw on top that you take the cap off, insert the mandrel of your choice, put the cap back on. That's the end of it. You set the mandrel housing at various types, at various heights, depending on whether you're working with a short or a long cartridge. And the goal is to just make sure the mandrel inserts entirely into the neck. Now, what you're doing here is you're leaving a perfectly concentric neck once it's been expanded. The diameters of each and every piece of your brass are identical, which is your neck tension. Yep. And you're pushing all the imperfections to the outside of the neck by basically pre-seating a bullet.
Yes.
So, and if you pay the extra money and get the carbide version or the nitrided version from 21st century, you don't have to lube anything. Guys often think they have to, you know, use some type of lubricant or this and that. We don't use any lube on our cases at all.
Right.
And we do keep our carbide mandrels very clean by, again, chucking them up in a cordless drill and taking some, you know, something like 3000 grit sandpaper, which is basically not much at all, and spinning the mandrel inside the paper to keep it clean. Okay. Probably every couple hundred rounds or so, we're making sure the mandrel's clean. It'll get a buildup of brass.
Yeah.
And then that will in turn start to mess with your neck tension and diameter at that point.
Do you, if you're using that sandpaper, is there a risk that you're going to take that 0.001 difference out of it?
No, we're talking basically. So the grit on the sandpaper it's just enough to kind of stop your finger from moving on. It's super, super, the finest grit sandpaper you can find. And yeah, I mean, if you sat there and spin it in the sandpaper, you know, for a long time, I'm sure you can have an effect.
But you tried.
That carbide steel is super hard, and you know, I don't think there's a lot of risk there. So you can have one mandrel housing with all of the different carbide expander mandrels that fit the different calibers you might be shooting. And by caliber refers directly to the diameter of the bullet.
Yes.
So a lot of guys will talk about a specific cartridge, but they'll call it a caliber. So just remember the caliber is 6mm, 6.5, 7mm, and so on.
Yes.
So once you've expanded the brass, so 1,000th under bullet diameter, you'll have 5/10,000ths of spring back on well annealed brass. In other words, if the brass hardness is consistent, it'll give you about 5/10,000ths spring back to set your final neck tension at about 1.5/1,000ths.
Now, annealing is the process of heating the neck, right?
Yes. You basically heat the brass up enough to relax all of the molecules to have the most relaxed metal for the most consistent neck tension. So throughout the process of shooting, as your brass is blown out and then sized back down and blown out and sized back down, those molecules become disoriented from each other. They're not aligned, and that gives you different levels of brass hardness. So for brass alloy, it needs to hit 750 degrees in order to relax it properly. There are several ways to anneal brass, and we don't anneal, we use almost all, well, we use all quality brass, but all brass is annealed something like 9 times throughout the process of making a brass cartridge, because they, each and every time they move, you know, they form the brass from a little disc. As they're forming the brass, it's annealed many times. So any brass you receive is annealed. So until you start to fire it and you're work hardening the brass, but we do anneal on every firing, both for our customers and ourselves. So keep that in mind. And that's a critical part of consistent neck tension, which is the second most important part of your loading process.
Okay.
So you've expanded the neck. It's now ready to be three-way trimmed. And by three-way trimmed, it is deburring. And so deburring the outside of the neck, chamfering the inside of the neck, because if you have a sharp edge on the inside that drags on the bullet as you're seating the bullet, you're going to have inconsistency in your neck tension also. So deburr, chamfer, and trim to length. Now, guys might ask, oh, I shouldn't be trimming my new brass, something like this. Well, what we do for each lot of brass we receive in the shop is we'll measure length on 10 pieces. We'll take the shortest one, subtract 1/1,000th, and that is our trim length. We don't look in a book. We don't look at a minimum or maximum case length and all that stuff. We take that lot of brass specifically, and we don't take off more than is necessary to make sure each piece of brass is identical.
And that's per batch, because there's variations in every batch.
Absolutely. And that's another good point, is that for any good ammunition for the loader in the garage, lot to lot consistency is huge for you.
Okay.
So never different case heads, in other words, a head stamp, never different types of brass, basically. There's a lot of reasons why, but when you start off with a rifle, a good rifle always starts with 200 pieces of the best brass you can afford and find. To me, You have guys right now that are buying 6.5 PRC and 300 PRC rifles off the shelf and from their gun builders who literally cannot buy ammunition.
Yeah.
If you would have started your rifle build with 200 pieces of brass, you'd be just fine. Yeah. Once you have the brass, I mean, you can switch bullet, you can switch powder, you can switch primer, but you're not going to make brass.
Right.
So quality.
So you would do it that way. You would actually go and get the brass.
Yes. Before I ever thought about buying a rifle.
Right. Okay. Okay. Yes.
Because what good is a rifle without ammunition?
And, well, for sure. It's obvious when you say it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So with good brass, okay, so we're back to the length and so on. So three-way trimming, deeper, chamfer, and trim to length. We use a Henderson trimmer. Okay. Henderson is they're out of California, and it's probably for me it's the finest machine available in the market. It's all billet, you know, CNC aluminum machine. It's very nice. It's super accurate. It's indexing off the case head rather than the shoulder of a cartridge, which is important. And it's very fast. Like I could trim 200 pieces of brass in probably 15 minutes.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So a Henderson trimmer would be, you know, kind of the top end. And then there's all different levels of equipment for trimming. Most of them are, you know, you have some type of, three-way trimmers that attach to a cordless drill. Okay. Where you kind of, and really it comes down to the setup and the long-term investment. If you have a lot of cartridges, Henderson is a very low cost of investment to run multiple cartridges. A Giraud, Giraud, would be probably the comparison trimmer to the Henderson. The Henderson price point might be $750, the Giraud somewhere around $600.
Okay.
But the Giraud is indexing off the shoulder of the case, and it requires you to buy a collet for each and every cartridge you might trim. Okay. The Henderson trimmer is just a bolt that's adjusted to a different length as the mechanical hard stop for a given cartridge. So again, the Henderson, for my team in the shop here loading ammunition, being that it's a mechanical hard stop, it leaves very little room for error.
Yeah.
The Giraud, there's a ton of adjustment. If you were going to use one Giraud to trim 50 different cartridges, there's a lot of setup and potential error in the setup of each and every one. It's not repeatable for me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So once it's three-way trimmed, you want to keep going through the.
Yeah. That's
okay.
Good.
Okay. So three-way trimmed brass is now ready to be primed. Basically, priming is the process of putting the primer into the case head. And generally, there are, you know, there's a lot of discussion. We could talk about seating depth of the primer and so on. But I think just generally for the hand loader in the garage, you want to be below flush. That just means that if you run your finger across the top of the case head, the primer cannot be outside the case head because you begin to affect the head space in your rifle. Head space is a very small amount of tolerance. So let's say our target is 2/1000. If your primer is 3/1000 out of your case and you had 2/1000 worth of head space, that bolt will not drop on that round. So very important that your primer is below flush, and I think that's probably so whatever tool you might use, and again, you could spend from $650 down to maybe $25 depending on the level of repeatability you're looking for. And consistent depth of your primer is important to the consistency of your ammunition. As the firing pin moves forward and strikes the primer in the case head, if the primer is inconsistent, there is forward motion of that primer cup before it bottoms out inside the primer pocket of the brass before it ignites the primer. Right. So if you have a variable amount of primer cup movement before the detonation happens, you're going to, you know, introduce some inconsistencies in your ammunition.
Will you see that downrange? If you're getting that?
Yeah, for sure. You'll see it in extreme spread and standard deviation. If you have a problem getting your ES and SDs low, that's one of those things you can pay attention to is primer seating depth. They make several different tools to measure the depth of the primer. It's basically just a gauge or a tool. One of those, you could go to Holland's Shooter Supply. They make one. I want to say it's $50 or $60. And, of course, Meditoyo makes one. If you don't have the ability to measure primer depth and see how, you know, well or how consistent your tool is seating your primers, that's something that you can invest in. But definitely after all the other you know, just being below flush is important to this point. Once you've fine-tuned all the rest of these processes, you can start to worry about, you know, primer seating depth. So the tool we use in the shop is from a company called Primal Rights, and it is called the Competition Primer Seater. It is a hunk of billet aluminum with a mechanical hard stop and a micrometer adjustment, meaning that if your primer is, you know, 2,000ths below flush and you want it to be 3, it's one click of a knob, and it is now 3,000ths deep, and it's very, very repeatable.
That's cool.
That's about six. I want to say his price point's $600, somewhere right around $600. But again, that is just like the Henderson Tribber. That is, for me, the gold standard in manual seating of primers on the bench.
Yeah. Well, to have that level of precision, and of course, that is your business at the end of the day. That's how you market, right?
So part of a lot of guys hate to prime because they hate to pluck primers with those little tubes. So what we use is a Dillon RF100. That's basically a machine where you dump a pack of primers in the top, and it goes ahead and vibrates and sorts all those out and puts them into a tube for you. You're priming. So
that's the Dillon RF100. I'm gonna look that up while we're talking
here. Robert Frank 100. It's I want to say the price point on those, maybe somewhere around $300. And if you hate to pluck primers and you're loading enough rounds in your garage, that is a worthwhile investment.
Very good, very good. Oh, they're a bit more expensive here in the UK. Looks like we're getting stitched up.
Well, you got. I guess you got some import duties and taxes coming that way. Those are.
Oh, true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah. Okay, so we now have a new piece of brass. It's been expanded, three-way trimmed, and it has a primer in it. The next step would be to put a powder charge, and we've kind of covered that in depth with the different options you might have. Once your powder charge is in your – oh, I will say part of the powdering process, I tested a lot of different funnels to get the powder into the case. We use extreme hardcore gear is what they're called. It is a billet aluminum, you know, CNC milled funnel, and the enemy of powder is static.
Okay.
So whether you have a plastic hopper on your powder measure or you're using some type of plastic funnel, if one of those kernels is out of place, you are hurting your process.
Really?
Because again, it's kernel accurate powder throws is the goal here. So aluminum obviously doesn't hold on to any static charge like plastic does. So whether that be a Pyrex hopper for your powder measure, so Pyrex is a type of glass being, again, no static involved, or a aluminum funnel, those are some kind of, I guess, tricks of the trade is avoid losing one kernel of powder.
Interesting. Okay.
So then after that, the last step would be to seat a bullet. So seating a bullet, we talked a bit about that too, about thinking about it as a mechanical process and trying to eliminate variance. The goal here would be, and again, so something to bring up is you can't measure the accuracy or the precision of ammunition from the base to the tip of the bullet. There are a lot of manufacturing tolerances between the ogive and the tip of the bullet that provide that there's variance there. It could be up to 10,000ths difference from one bullet to another.
Right.
So if you're going to quality check your ammunition, make sure you're checking to the ogive. Now the ogive, to take it a step further, if you're looking at the side profile of a projectile of a bullet, the two flat parallel sides are what we call the bearing surface.
Okay.
So going towards the tip or I don't like using the word, but they call mepla or mepla. A lot of guys say it different, but that basically a fancy word for the tip of the bullet.
Okay.
So moving away from the bearing surface towards the tip of the bullet, the moment the bearing surface departs into the ogive is the curved part going towards the tip. That is the ogive. So to the ogive. So you have, if you're measuring base to ogive, it's at that exact point. So basically a bullet comparator is what you need to measure to the ogive. A bullet comparator, you'll need a comparator housing and a bullet comparator insert. That's the equivalent of your bullet caliber. Okay. You attach that tool to a digital caliper and you can measure the base to ogive of your ammunition. And I guess I should have said that, you know, a digital caliper is the most used and it's a critical piece of equipment in your hand loading process. We use the Mitutoyo AOS Alpha Oscar Sam Digimatic is the name of it. They're right around, let's say, $110. They're accurate to the 10,000th position. So that's four zeros after the period, after the decimal point.
Yep.
And there are a lot of fakes out there, so be careful for those of you that like to find a deal on eBay or something. There are a lot of...
You know, I was going to ask you about this, actually, as a separate thing. Is that something people have to worry about, you know, in terms of, like, the brass or the primers or, like you've just said, the caliper?
Yeah, I would say I don't see a lot of knockoffs or issues with components. I would say just because... in these day and times, the thing that bothers me is all the sellers on GunBroker. They're not knocking stuff off, but they're bumping prices 500%, and that's part of the big shortage problem. Also, is that a lot of these supplies, as they're hitting the big box stores and the retailers, let's just say that that's the other proponent of the shortage, is people are looking to make gains here.
The scalping.
People that don't ever buy ammo components are getting them ahead of time. Whether they wrote some type of bot that scours the internet for something and makes the purchase in milliseconds before the guy with his fingers gets there. Whether it's that or then looking to turn around and make it. And of course, you know, that's the retail market, I guess. And something's worth what somebody will pay for it, but.
Yeah, but it inflates it artificially. I mean, you get it with concert tickets or tickets to like big sporting events. Then someone will come in and they'll buy, I don't know, five or 10 tickets at a time and then scalp them, sell them on for twice the price. So you get this big show that sells out in 6 minutes, but in reality, it's meant to scalpers. And I guess that the same thing is happening with components.
Yeah. And how many guys do we have sitting around on a computer that know how to write, I guess they call them bots. I don't know what the right terminology is because I don't know how to do it, but little programs that, like Powder Valley is a big source of gunpowder on here, and they don't have any type of waitlist notification. So when they do a drop of powder on the website, the only way you really can get in there and get some is if you're literally watching it nonstop and refreshing your screen, right? So they write these little bots to watch a page, and they're refreshing every millisecond and then sending you an alert every time, the stock status changes. And I wish I knew how to do that, because we'd be all right if I could do that. But if any of you listeners out there know how to do that, please contact
me. I was going to say, any hackers?
yes.
Get in touch with Jake.
I have some work for you. So seating the bullet, we talked about. So again, top of the line press is a new release from Area 419. It's called a zero press. And there's a lot of resistance, I think, to the zero press from Area 419, because it's a much higher price point than anybody has seen from a press. So it's $1,200. It is a massive billet aluminum masterpiece that's literally built by hand here in the U.S. And it is the epitome of precision and tight tolerance. I mean, this thing is it is tight.
Yeah,
it is. Now, okay, I will say, so we started with Redding T7 presses, and one of the ways that we were able to get repeatable results in a tool that you guys can use, in your garage, is it's called Camover.
Okay.
And what camover means, and it depends on the type of die you're using too. Just if it's an interference type of die, you can't do this. But a Redding competition seater is what I'm talking about to set up camover. And what it means is that you set your die up, you run your ram to the top, and you screw your die down until it engages the shell holder.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go just a bit further down until at the bottom of your press lever stroke, you get a little bit of camover. And that's where you feel a little resistance at the end, like the shell holder is bottoming out on the bottom of the die.
Yeah.
And what that's doing is it's taking out all of the slop in the mechanisms in the press itself, and all the linkage. There are little pins and little variances where if you just allowed the cartridge to free float up into the die, all of those little spots are going to introduce, variance in your bullet seating depth. So the way to eliminate any variance from the press itself, so literally the press actually doesn't matter in this situation. If you have camover and the shell holder is bottomed out at the base of the die, the press is eliminated from that process.
Okay.
And then in turn, so you would adjust the micrometer on the top of the die for the right seating depth. As long as you're able to achieve the right overall length with that die setup. Now, we run, for example, 28 Nozzer, we run at 3.6 inches for most loads, and most dies in the world are set up to a SAMI length piece of ammunition. So if the SAMI length is 3.4, that die may not be built for that length of ammunition. The only way to accommodate the length is to rotate your die and move your die upwards to give you that extra length. And once you move it upwards and eliminate the cam over, you now have all that introduced variance from the linkage of the press. So that's where the zero press shines, is that at the bottom stroke of that press, it is perfect. Okay. It hits the same spot with such precision every time that you can now take your die and you don't have to worry about cam over anymore. You can just move it up and it's the same as cam over. So that's where it appeals to our process in the shop. And
I can see that 100%.
I mean, you grab this thing and pull the lever and there's, you know, you can't describe it until you pull the lever on a T7 and you pull the lever on a zero press. And it is, it's a world of difference. All silky smooth.
Nice. Yeah. I've watched a few videos and YouTube of people pressing at home, and some of them have, you can see the movement in the machine. You can see the work counts at bowing as they're doing it. You can see there's so much movement in the whole process, and you think, well, that's not precise. You see how these CNCs make things. They're incredibly precise. The tolerances are so tight. They're just not even in the same league. So how could you expect the same result from that? So, I mean, is you made this point in another podcast, so I know the answer, but is hand-loaded ammo always better?
No, it's not. it's not. It really comes down to tooling and experience and skill. And if you take, let's take Hornady Precision Hunter ammunition is used all over the world and is very, very good ammunition. For what you're purchasing and what you're getting from Hornady, it is a you know, proprietary powder blend used in a cartridge. You know, let's take 6.5 Creedmoor, 6.5 PRC. Both cases are designed by Hornady. They're using Hornady-designed bullets so that the ogive is in the right relationship in a SAMI chamber, and it's the right amount of pressure in the case, and everything works together beautifully, and it's fantastic ammunition. And really, that's a good point to bring up, is then why would you buy 6.5 Creedmoor with the same components from unknown munitions rather than the Precision Hunter ammo? And the difference ends up being not only based to ogive differences in bullet position, but it's extreme spread.
Yeah.
And extreme spread, for those listening, is the difference between the highest velocity and lowest velocity in a shot string. And that directly correlates to the bullet's flight path, you know, as it's flying down range. And and it's not critical for, let's say, targets inside of 500 yards or 500 meters. But once you get further out, you will start to notice your ammunition's performance when you're trying to hit, you know, a 1,000-yard target and be within an MOA. And it's very easy to, I mean, that's what I love about ammunition and shooting in general, is most of it is just math. Yeah. So take your Hornady box of ammo and take your chronograph and go to the range and shoot. Check your ES on a shot string of 5. You're going to find it be 50, 60, 70, 80 feet per second difference. And then take your ballistic calculator and run in the same atmospheric, same air density. Look at the bullet drop at 1,000 yards between the two velocities. And that is your potential miss factor that is engineered into your ammunition before you ever take all of the other possible areas of you know, in your
all the other gear.
Yes, all your other gear aside, just in the box of ammo you purchase, you've built in an 18-inch error at 1,000 yards.
Wow.
So that's what we do. That's what we – if you buy 6.5 Creedmoor from me, our goal is single-digit ES.
Right.
And through these processes that I've described, that's very attainable for any loader in his garage. But a lot of guys may not want to spend $15,000 on tooling to get started. But you can spend the same amount of money on our ammo as you would on a box of Hornady ammo, and you're going to get, you know, much lower ESs that in turn make you a better shooter.
That is, well, it's undeniable. I mean, when you that's what I like about it, is it's not an art, it's a science. Mm-hmm. It's very controllable and it's very measurable. And yes. When you put it like that and you say, you know, go out and test it yourself and look at the ES and then look at our ES, you know, how can you argue with the figures?
Yes.
I mean, you can't really, is this, because this follows on a bit, but precision rifle is huge now, obviously. It's informing a lot of what happens in the shooting industry. It's making people want to shoot further and hunt at greater distances. Would you say that the custom ammunition, like you're talking about, and that achieving that low ES is absolutely non-negotiable for performing well in that sort of arena?
I don't think it's as critical. And the reason being is, you know, in PRS, you know, you might have targets ranging from, let's say, 500 to 800 yards. And
yeah, sure.
it's really the size of, because it's just an impact is all that matters. And if you're dealing with, you know, an MOA or two MOA or three MOA size target at whatever distance it might be, an impact, you know, so one MOA accuracy might be acceptable.
Yeah.
Now when you get past that 500 yard mark, if you're only shooting 1 inch at 100, you know, if you measure out that MOA at 800 yards, you know, you might have some issues there. But again, in the competing world, whether you're trying to be a better competition shooter or a better hunter,
yeah,
your pursuit should always be, you know, using the best equipment possible and eliminating variables.
For
so
sure.
That being said, again, if the ammo price is the same, whether you load your own or you buy from some custom ammo manufacturer, I mean, low ES is critical whether you're hunting or whether you're competition shooting. I just think that you don't need to have it's not as hugely important for the PRS guys. I think that, you know, they're more focused on cartridge efficiency, barrel life. In other words, 6 Creedmoor versus 6 GT.
Sure.
6 Creedmoor might have a 1200 round barrel life, so you're already knowing that, but it gives you maybe a slight ballistic edge. You know, if some of the other areas of your weapon system are lacking, maybe you need that little bit of extra horsepower for, you know, less wind drift and things like that. Whereas 6 GT, maybe it cycles better barrel life. But I think as a whole, the PRS community is probably centered on the 6mm caliber is maybe the go-to.
Yes.
And now they're kind of fine-tuning, playing with case capacity, cartridge shape versus barrel life. And so, in other words, shoulder angle, you know, has an effect on barrel life and throat erosion. So I really think that this year, maybe most guys would tell you that the 6 GT form might be, you know, the best going forward. Us here personally, we're waiting for Peterson to finally come out with their 6 GT brass so that we can start loading it for guys. But yeah.
Do you experiment with bullet design yourself or with cartridge design rather?
Definitely not. Right. Part of being an ammo manufacturer is we do stick strictly to head stamped brass only, being that there's, you know, there's insurance and things and liabilities that are involved with wildcatting and fireforming.
Okay.
And fireforming in itself, I'll say this too, is the other side of that is I had a guy argue with me the other day on Instagram, and it's interesting, you know, to hear the new 6.8 Western cartridge that was just released, which is basically just a shortened 270 WSM.
Okay.
And his argument was that the ballistics are better for 6.8 Western. And again, this is just marketing. Marketing is fantastic, but in his point of view is a valid one. And I'll say that for Sammy spec ammo, in other words, if you have an overall length for 270 WSM that only allows you to use a certain weight bullet because of length, you know, in order to fit in, you know, that Sammy overall length or CIP overall length, you can't use a heavier, longer, sleeker bullet like the 6.8 Western can. But when it comes to, see, I look at ammo as custom ammunition. In other words, you can make it any length you want if you build a custom rifle and build custom ammunition. So it's for 270 WSM, there are no limitations in my eyes that 6.8 Western and 270 WSM will use the exact same bullet if you can build it how you want it. And 270 WSM just has more case capacity. So naturally, it is going to be a better cartridge, you know, for long range. But his argument was valid in that if you look at it from a non-hand loader production rifle perspective, then yeah, the marketing, you know, I'm sure their numbers are inflated, but the argument is there is that if it's off the shelf ammo that's built to a SAMI specification, then yeah, it might have a little more efficiency. But yeah, so that's two different ways to look at ammo
Yeah, clearly there's some crossover as well, isn't there, between, well, there's many crossovers between the different disciplines that people are using the ammunition for, the different type of rifle setup they're running, how they've approached their rifle build. Like you've said, you know, approach it brass first, like get the brass, choose the cartridge, build accordingly.
Yeah, there's more, there's a little more to it. Like, this last rifle we just built to hunt with is a 300 RUM, but we literally built the rifle around the exact ammunition that I wanted to shoot.
Right.
So 300 RUM has an overall length, a SAMI overall length, I think it's 3.6. My round is shooting a 215 hybrid at 3.93 inches long.
Oh, wow.
So that involves selecting an action that can fit a 4-inch round without modification. It involved a internal box that was from Wyatt's that can accept a 4-inch round.
Right.
We wanted to use a 20-inch barrel. So again, matching twist rate with velocity without over revving a bullet is important. So we literally built this package, built this rifle around the idea of a piece of ammunition. That's kind of a new way to look at rifle building. And we're taking that one step further. We're building a set of rifles this year that will be for sale, and it has the same idea as we, as a custom ammunition manufacturer primarily, we have a different outlook on the way to build a rifle, like I said, build the rifle around the highest performance piece of ammunition that you can build. And a 215 hybrid at 3,100 feet a second out of a 20-inch barrel, 8-pound hunting rifle is insanely, you know, the potential of that round will, you know.
That is, that makes a lot of sense. Like, it's almost like, I mean, is anyone else doing that at the moment? Is anyone pushing that angle? Because it seems like the ammunition is such a key differentiator at those longer ranges. How could you not take it into account, in the first instance?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not really, I mean, a lot of people are doing, let's say, custom rifle packages that come with ammunition and the sort, but I think this viewpoint of building a rifle around the ammo instead of the opposite, I don't really think that a lot of guys look at it that way. And really there, so that being said, as far as wildcatting or testing cartridges, it's my belief that for any bullet to go any feasible velocity, there is a cartridge out there that in its normal form can achieve your goal. Yep. Without wildcatting it. In other words, you don't need to improve the shoulder if you build the rifle around the bullet, you know, like my 300 RUM. So that's with Vitvarian 570. A lot of hand loaders use it. It's a very highly sought after powder here in the U.S.
Yeah.
And I know it's much more available over in your, is it more available out by you, Vitvary powder?
Good question. I don't know. I'd have to look it up.
Well, it is made, in your neck of the woods and, you know, So into the United States, Capstone Group imports it. But basically, I don't know of anybody that's building ammunition with N570. And it is, for me, it is a highly sought-after powder for Magnum cartridges, Magnum long-action cartridges. And that's what we're doing. So, yeah, it's a new project of ours. And there will be some available this year.
I know the one you mean, the N570. This is the one that comes in the big kernels, the big lumpy.
Yes, yes. Right. Big hunks of rice. And that is that powder. It's a double base powder. So again, from a hunting point of view, I'm not after barrel life. I don't even care about brass life.
Right.
For me, it's about that one shot.
Yeah, yeah.
Hitting exactly where I want it to, going as fast as possible.
Yeah,
you know, and making the one shot count. So if we talk about brass life and so on, I'm running high pressure. I'm, you know, running a bullet as fast as humanly. That's the powder that gets you there, and that's me building a rifle and ammunition from the hunting perspective to be max performance. And those rifle packages are going to be load developed with 100 rounds of ammo and all the load data. And again, so that, just a different way to look at the game, I think.
Awesome, man. Well, that's exciting. That answered another question, because I was going to ask you, what are you running right now? And now we know, 300 RUM.
Yeah, 300 RUM. And, you know, I would say that my all-time favorite cartridge at the moment would be 300 Norma. And it would have been 300 Norma, except for that action that I used Right. Because it's an aluminum housing action, you could not get a Lapua bolt face for it.
Right.
But 300 Norma is probably, so if you take those two cartridges, 300 rum versus 300 Norma, the 300 rum is doing the same thing the 300 Norma can in my rifle right now, but a 300 Norma can get it done with 10% less powder.
Okay.
So that's speaking to the efficiency of a cartridge, and that has to do with the shorter, fatter powder column and the way it burns compared to. Oh, another thing to mention for those of you, a 300 rum at 3.93 inches does burn 99 grains of N570 completely. Right. In other words, between 99 and 100 grains of N570, we still had a 35 feet per second increase in velocity. So it is all being burnt, and that was part of the test with this short barrel rifle.
It sounds like a very potent rifle build, that one. Do you have any pictures of that on the website if people want to have a look at it?
They're not on the website. So the other part of the idea of building these is that I basically have everything ordered already, and you know, getting a custom rifle built is to me horribly stressful because you're overloaded with choices. You know, whether it be barrel type, barrel twist rate, barrel length, barrel profile. That's just talking about a barrel. Then cartridge choice, stock choice, action choice. So I have a good idea of what works really well for us in that package, and we're trying to eliminate the lead time. So when these are available, they'll be available for purchase now. And again, eliminating all the choices from the consumer. Now, our biggest form of communication right now is actually Instagram. We don't do a lot on the website as far as announcements or the such, but we're pretty big on Instagram, and we announce new ammo that drops and things like that. And
it's a good visual platform, isn't it? I think that's the thing. It works well for the gun industry.
It is, and I think without Instagram, when I first started, it would have been really difficult to kind of take off. And I think now we're over something over 12,000 followers. And when we, our base of followers, we do question days. Like, for example, tomorrow I'll do a question day where, they're allowed to ask any question they want in the story, and we post answers. And it's a tool. So now it's a tool for us to market and advertise, but it's also a tool for the loader to get to ask questions maybe once a week, and to see, I try to put some education in there at the same time.
And, Oh, very cool, man. Where can people find that? What's your tag?
Instagram is just Unknown Munitions. Website unknownmunitions.com, and sales@unknownmunitions.com for email, and all the other contact info is definitely on our site or through Instagram. And we did actually just add a new load development tool to our website as well, where it allows anybody for free to go to the website. They click load development tool. They can input their atmospheric data. Then they can input the velocities from their shot strings. And it's basically an app that's integrated in the website. The app will generate a PDF with graphs and spreadsheets to help you identify barrel velocity nodes and basically extrapolate your load data and interpret it to be useful for you. So
that's awesome. So they can come to your site, use that tool, develop the ammo with you, and then receive the product. Once they've done that, do you keep presumably the order, and they can just repeat order that exact same ammunition as many times as they want?
Oh yeah, for sure. And that tool specifically, it's not just for them to buy anything from us. It's really, if you're a new hand loader at home and you're doing some type of load development and you have a chronograph and you've measured the velocities between your different shot strings and different charge weights, when you plug it into the tool, it visualizes the data for you. So it'll give you your ESSDs, but also a line chart where your goal is to find a barrel velocity node, where basically a flat spot in the line.
Right.
Where, you have a good load there for your rifle. But so it's just it doesn't have to, be you purchasing ammo from us. It's a good tool to use, I think, for anybody that's doing load development.
That's awesome, man. Like a very, very helpful tool. Definitely worth checking out. Do you have what's coming up in I'm conscious we've gone over the hour, man. Sorry to eat into your time here.
Oh, you're fine.
What's coming up in 2021 for Unknown Munitions?
I think we were ready. We're bulging out of the seams in our current shop, and we did have a goal to move to something bigger, but I think this year we are going to try and just take things as they come and hopefully get through this shortage. The shortage is having a large effect on our business.
For sure.
And, you know, if things were in a normal situation now, the business would probably be 5 or 10 times what it is. So our goal is to make it through this year and come out the other side, which I have no doubt that we will. But to continue offering our customers, you know, both education, but, you know, we're here for the shooter. I get guys that, you know, I get 50 calls a day, whether it's guys that want to talk through their load development and they want to, you know, do their own load development and have us build boxes for them, but just to help the shooter. We're here to make you a better shooter.
That's awesome.
Is really what it's about. So we also have we have reloading classes, like in-person reloading classes. We're doing 3 this year.
Yeah.
Everything's posted up on the site. It'll be a hands-on class. It won't be virtual. Cool. It won't be a presentation. I have 2 benches with all the equipment we use in our process, and you'll be able to put your hands on it. So whether you're trying to figure out if you want to get into loading or basically see our process firsthand, it's a 1-day class. Yeah, a few different locations in the U.S. for this year.
Man, that sounds awesome. Like, not just saying it, that sounds like something super worth doing. Just to even be able to play with that gear.
Yes.
The stuff
yes,
you've listed. Sure.
I wish that I could have taken a class before I started and seen all the levels of gear to and again, understand where to spend my money, where not to.
Because
I did what most guys do. You start at the bottom and then you progress. You sell that one, you buy the next one. You sell that one, you buy the next one. Until you realize that, man, I should have just jumped in the first place. I would have saved some money. So
yeah, buy one, cry once, like you said.
There you go.
So, man, thank you so much. You've given us a huge amount of information now. I'm sure that people, they could listen to that back 3 or 4 times and be picking stuff out of it and refining their process. I didn't send this question through to you on the email. I apologize. I put you on the spot here. So take your time. We usually finish by saying, what are your words to live by? And this could be your motto in your business, in your day-to-day life. Just something that sums up, what sums up for you, what you're about and your ethos.
Oh man. Well, I am I'm not a type of guy to beat around the bush or sugarcoat things. I think that truth and speaking your mind is highly important. I think that you should always be yourself in any situation. Whether, you know, you're worried about pleasing somebody or not. So if they, speak the truth, I guess.
Awesome, man. Fantastic.
Yeah.
It's a tough one, isn't it? I'm sorry to put you on the spot, dude.
No, it's fine. I think, you know, sometimes like I'll talk with guys on the phone. I've had guys hang up on me because, you know, if you call me and ask me if I can make Hornady 6.5 precision hunter ammo, I'm going to tell you, well, you basically just asked me if I could put a Ferrari in your Honda Civic. You know, I'm not trying to, you know, I'm just blunt with guys and some guys take it well, some guys don't. So yeah, I think just always being yourself and whether they like it or not.
You've been listening to the Tier 1 Podcast, brought to you by Tier 1, makers of the world's finest rifle accessories. Find out more at tier-1-usa.com. And tune in for more great insights on the next episode.